up with me made the heart of the people melt. But I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land where you your foot has stepped will be an inheritance for you and your children forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God. Caleb's speech continues. He says, and now, behold, the Lord has kept me alive, as he spoke, these 45 years, from the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel walked in the wilderness, and now I am this day 85 years old. And as yet I am as strong this day as I was in the day that Moses sent me. As my strength was then, even so is my strength now, for war and for all my duties. Now, therefore, give me this mountain where the Lord spoke that day, for you yourself heard that day how the Anakim, the giants, were there, and the cities were great and fortified. Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I will drive them out, as the Lord spoke. And Joshua blessed him, and he gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, for an inheritance. Therefore, Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord, the God of Israel. The name of Hebron before was Kiriat Arba. It's the town of four. Which Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim, and the land had rest from war. We are taking a journey through the book of Joshua. We have, up until this point, traveled with the people from Moab across, heading west, across the Jordan River into the land. Wonderful stories of how they crossed the river. Literally, the presence of God was there in a really wild, dramatic way as they entered the land. And there they camped just a couple miles from Jericho in the site of this great, big, huge, fortified city, one of the very oldest cities in the ancient Near East. But there, without fear, they camped there next to their enemies. And the Lord gave them this strange plan about how they were to walk around the city for 7 days. Not saying anything, not doing it, just walk. And God won the victory. Later, Israel went on, after they celebrated Passover, to attack a city called Ai. And there they were defeated. Joshua found out that someone, a family in his nation, had sinned. And they first had to deal with the sin issue. Then they went back, and God once again gave them the victory. This time it wasn't as easy as just walking around the city. This time they had to fight. But God won the battle. We've seen amazing stories how the sun was silent in the sky when Joshua prayed for darkness, for the sun to stay away so the darkness would, the night would remain, and so he could fight off the people who were attacking their friends, the people of Gibeon. And so we have seen that in different parts of the land of Canaan, Israel had to attack those that came against them, sometimes with greater technology than they had, sometimes vastly outnumbered. Israel went in to battle. At this point, it's been 7 years since they crossed the Jordan River. Their battles are completed. We see that there's still work to be done. There, it seems that there was always an element within the land that was not fully subdued. There was always, Rav Rod likes to say that there was always within the community both wheat and weeds, taking the image from Messiah's parable. That he talks about how in a field of wheat, there's always weeds. And so that was Israel experienced there in the land. The major battles have been completed, and now, at this point in the book, there are seven chapters discussing the division of the land, how the land is divided between the various tribes. Seven chapters. It's not just as easy as saying, so the tribe of Judah gets that section in the next verse. It says, and the tribe of Dan gets that section, and so on, and for each of the tribes. What it does almost is it breaks it down almost chapter by. It takes an entire chapter, for instance, to talk about the land that the tribe of Judah gets. It's very, very specific. Very detailed. Seven chapters in the heart of the book of Joshua, it talks about their inheritance. It begins, this section of Joshua begins with the story we just read of a guy named Caleb asking for a specific spot. I want that spot. In fact, he asked for a specific city and the fields around it. So who is this Caleb guy? Think way back to the stories in the book of Numbers. Remember just weeks after the people left Mount Sinai, they came to a spot and Moses decided that he would send 12 scouts, to spy out the land. They were gone for 40 days scouting out the land, and when they came back, they had amazing stories to tell. Look at the fruit. Look at the land. It's a land of milk and honey. And as my friend Aaron likes to say, it sounds sticky and wet. Milk and honey. And so one of the reports that they gave, though, was that there's giants in the land. At least that's how we think that we must look to them, because their cities are big and their walls are high and they're going to squash us like a grasshopper. That's what it says. Caleb, along with Joshua, were two of the 12 scouts that Moses sent. All the rest of the scouts, the other 10, brought back a negative report. We can't do it. We can't go there. We're going to die. It's over. We're done. Moses, why'd you bring us out of Egypt to take us to that? Is that the land that God promised? But Caleb stood up and said, no, man. No, this is the promise. This is what God has been bringing us to. Caleb tried to calm the people, but the people rose up, rebelled, said, no, we're not going. We can't do this. As a punishment, God said that all the people, because they slandered God's land, the blood slandered God's promises. God said that everyone over the age of 20 will die in the wilderness over the next 40 years. So anyone over the age of 20 that came out of Egypt died. And so except Caleb and Joshua. They were the only two guys over the age of 20 that lived to enter into the promised land 39 years later. So in other words, the two oldest guys in the community of Israel at the beginning of the book of Joshua are Joshua and Caleb. They are the senior elders. So this is the story. This is the background on Caleb. We are told in this section that he was the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite. And I have always challenged you, when you read about places, when you read about names in Scripture, find out who they are, because genealogy is important. Do you think it's important where you came from, your hometown, your people, who your grandfather was? And the same thing in Scripture. They think it's important who somebody's grandfather is, and or great-great-great-grandfather. And if you dig back to the book of Genesis, chapter 36, verses 10 through 12, Genesis 36, you will find out that Kenaz, get this, is the grandson of Esau. The Kenizzites were a Canaanite, Edomite tribe in the land of Canaan. Caleb is a descendant of Esau. In case that doesn't strike you, remember that Kenaz has a cousin, had a cousin named Amalek, who made it his business to harass Israel continuously. God said of Esau and the Edomites that they are a people that I will pursue forever. In fact, the book of Malachi puts it in even starker terms, that I won't go there now, what God really thinks of the Edomites. But here was Caleb, a descendant of an Edomite. Caleb had been adopted into the tribe of Judah. It's obvious that perhaps somewhere back generations earlier, he had had a father that married a woman from the tribe of Judah or something of this sort, and he had been incorporated into the tribe of Judah because there is a perpetual link between Caleb and the tribe of Judah. But keep in mind, Caleb was an outsider. He had a pedigree and ancestry that wasn't so rosy and perfect. What else do we know about Caleb? I want to suggest that Caleb was a man of humility. A man of humility. If you start doing the math on the ages of Caleb and Joshua, you will learn that Caleb is actually older than Joshua. Remember when Moses was getting ready to die, it was Moses' job to assign, appoint a leader who would lead the people after his death to become the successor of Moses. And it's interesting to me that Moses bypassed the senior elder. Moses went to the young kid, Joshua. We know that Josh, one of the reasons we know that Caleb was older than Joshua is that Caleb gives his age here, what age he was when he went to spy out the land. He was 40 years old. At that point, Joshua is still called a Na'ar, a young man. Joshua is considerably younger than Caleb, perhaps like the difference between a baby boomer and a Gen Xer. He's perhaps a couple decades younger than Caleb. But Caleb, when he was overlooked for the lead position in Israel, had no anger He had no resentment. Not once do we ever read of Caleb angry at the fact that he did not become Moses' successor. Instead, it was the young guy, you know, the kid, Joshua, that got the role. Caleb was a man of humility. There was no pride in Caleb. Caleb was also a man of prayer. There is an interesting verse in Numbers chapter 13 where it's talking about the spies going out to the city to do their reconnaissance in the land of Canaan. It says in, well, I completely lost the page. In Numbers 13, verse 22, speaking of the spies, most translations say that the spies went up into the south or into the Negev, and they came to Hebron. Hebron being a city that's about 20 miles south of Jerusalem. The Hebrew literally says they went up, the spies, plural, went up to the Negev, and then in the singular says, and he went to Hebron. It is actually not uncommon for the Hebrew to switch in the middle of a sentence from a plural to a singular, or the other way around. And it could be that it's referring to they as a unit together went to Hebron, and thus it says that it's referring to all of them going. But this is the kind of thing that have always made the rabbis, intrigued to say, well, why does it say the plural, they went up to the Negev, and then only singular, he went to Hebron? This is the thing that causes Midrashim to be written, so they invent stories to explain these kinds of anomalies. What the rabbis came up with was that indeed they all went up to spy out the land, but only Caleb went to Hebron. The singular he that went to Hebron would be Caleb. And the question was then asked, well, why did Caleb go to Hebron? And again, we asked ourselves, what happened in the past at Hebron? Where has that come up in the Bible stories in the past? Hebron was the place where the cave was that Abraham bought as a burial ground for himself and his wife. Ultimately, his son and his wife, Isaac and Rebekah, were buried there, and Jacob and Leah were buried there at the cave at Hebron. And according to Jewish tradition, Adam and Eve were buried there also. Thus, it is called Kiryat Arba, the city of the four, the city of the four couples. So that's the tradition, at least. The question is, so why would Caleb go to Hebron to visit the burial place of Abraham? And the answer is that Caleb wanted to pray. He wanted to ask God to give him wisdom in this journey of spying out the land. He needed strength to stand against these 10 guys that wanted to, were only going to bring a bad report. He needed strength from the Lord. Caleb was, according to Jewish tradition, a man of prayer. In fact, in this section that we read from Joshua chapter 14, it says that Caleb brought the message, I think it's it was in verse 7. Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me to spy out the land, and I brought him back the word that was in my heart. The idea is that Caleb held his peace. Caleb was not an agitator. Caleb was a man of peace. Caleb was a man that, while the other 10 guys during their spy mission, the other 10 guys were going like, this is awful. We can't do this. Look, we need to get out of here. Look at those giants. Let's put it in B for boogie and get on our way. Caleb didn't join in their slander, but he also didn't let them know that he disagreed with them. There is a Jewish rabbi from some centuries ago named the Kofetz Chaim, the desire of life is his little monogram. He asked a question, is it if you find yourself living among people that are not righteous, how should you respond? Should you stand against them and oppose them verbally? Should you take an immediate stand? Or should you relax? Should you listen to them and wait for a chance to respond when the opportunity would be best? Perhaps when you might have the largest audience with which to address. The answer is that it depends. The rabbi concludes that there are pros and cons to either one. If you immediately respond, if you open your mouth and immediately respond, everyone knows exactly where you stand, and they will try to convince you that you're wrong, and they will try to change your mind. But if you wait, the idea of when you wait to do anything, the chances of you actually doing it diminish. But the positive could be, well, perhaps you need to calculate when is the best time to respond to these people. Perhaps in the moment is not the right time. Perhaps there's an opportunity that you might have when the audience might be more appropriate. And from Caleb, we see that he took the second of those options. Joshua was an outspoken individual. We see this in the Torah. There's a tradition that's why Moses changed Joshua's name from Hoshea to Yehoshua. Moses changed Joshua's name, adding the letter Yod to his name, which is the first letter of God's holy name. Moses changed Joshua's name because Moses knew that Joshua was impulsive. Joshua needed the support from God. Moses didn't change Caleb's name because Moses knew that Caleb was not impulsive. So, I don't know. Interesting idea I came across in the literature this week. Caleb is a man of prayer. Caleb is a man of humility. Caleb is a man who is not self-seeking, and he's not impulsive. Caleb is also a man who is ready to fight when he needs to respond. Did you get this? How old is this guy? He says, today I am 85 years old, verse 10. Yet I am as strong today as I was that day 45 years ago when Jesus sent me to fight. Here I come back to where I started at the beginning. The idea about getting older to be, I have never, ever heard anyone say, I can't wait till I'm 85. But, yeah, I know, you laugh. Proverbs 20, verse 29, it says, the glory of a young man is his strength. The glory of a young man is his strength, and gray hair is the splendor of those who are old. Sometimes in today's culture, we try to cover up the gray. I don't want to have so much splendor. But it doesn't, by the way, mean that just because you are old, that you have wisdom, that you can give good counsel. It doesn't mean that you deserve respect just because you get old. By the way, old people can sin too. Remember, Moses was quite old when he sinned in Numbers chapter 20. Being old doesn't mean that you're not going to sin anymore. What the blessing is of being older is that you have had the compilation of a lifetime to learn how to trust God. Good counsel and wisdom does not come with just having gray hair and reaching a certain decade. Having wisdom and good counsel is that you've learned throughout your life, through the struggle, through the troubles, how to trust God. It's beyond the scope of the current discussion, but I encourage you to read Psalm 71. Psalm 71 is a poem about someone getting older and learning how to trust God. It's this exact issue. With age, we are told that your money will compound and grow. Time is the most amazing ingredient to cause your investments to grow, if you're into that sort of thing. I remember when I was 20, my dad teaching me the rule of 72. It's an investment strategy. And I was like, great, Dad, that sounds wonderful if I had any money to invest. He said, well, if you start investing so much a month right now, by the time you're 65, it will be this much. And it's like, again, great, Dad. I can pay my bills, but that's about all I can do. Time is what causes investments to grow. The longer you have your money in investment, the greater the compounding return. That is, if you don't spend your dividends. The same is true for wisdom. Life is for growing in wisdom. The more you live, the more counsel that you have learned through the struggles and the trials and the difficulties, the more that you've learned how to place these things at God's feet. This is why in the book of Proverbs, it is the young that are described as impulsive. They have not yet learned that kind of stability in their life. That psalm that we read today, Psalm 92, in our prayers earlier, spoke of that in old age, the righteous will still bear fruit. They will still be fresh and green. Isn't that wonderful? The righteous, even when they get old, will still be fruitful. I want that. I want to be like Caleb. When I'm 85, I can say, I'm still as strong today as I was 45 years ago, which would be pretty close to my age now. There is a freshness. Well, let me, one of my favorite contemporary commentators, a rabbi by the name of Joseph Hertz, put it this way about Psalm 92. He said that when the righteous grow old, they enter into a new springtime. There is a new fruitfulness, a new vitality, a new freshness, a new vigor. Psalm 92 says that when the righteous age, they become not less vigorous, but more vigorous. Caleb didn't think about, it'll look so foolish for an old guy like me to be out, you know, fighting giants in Hebron. Note that Caleb picked a place that still had to be subdued. It wasn't a place that had already been conquered. He wanted a battle to fight. He wasn't ready to sit back and do nothing. Did you know the Bible doesn't talk about retirement? I'm thrilled. If you can retire, that's wonderful. Go for it. Do it. The Bible doesn't talk about retirement. The Bible talks about changing duties, about taking on new and different tasks. Not doing nothing. In fact, I actually had lunch with a retired person this week that said, well, since I've retired, I'm busier than I've ever been, actually. And that's the idea. And this person volunteers, finds things to do. They're like Caleb. They're out there finding a new place. It's also interesting that Hebron was the place that, according to Jewish tradition, he visited 45 years earlier when he went to that cave at Machpelah. He harbored the vision of that place in his mind for decades, through most of his adult life. And when he was 85 years old, he could say, God promised me that I would be alive to come back to this place. I love that. God told me that I would live. God has kept his promise. I'm alive, and I want to go back. I want that place that I visited 45 years ago to be my inheritance. He had fostered that vision, that dream, for all these years. And even at the age of 85, he wasn't willing to give up his vision, his dream. He didn't think it would look foolish for some gray-haired guy to be heading off to the mountains to pursue fighting for that city. In our lives, we come to a place where we think maybe it's time to slow down. We think maybe it's time to do something different. Maybe you're young and you have those kinds of quandaries too. It's a restlessness. But I asked, what is the vision that God has given you? What is God pulling you back to? If you read Caleb's speech carefully, it lasts from verse 6 all the way through verse 12. It's like 7 verses. He mentions God about 8 times in his speech. He is a man that has remained loyal. Just as he prayed as a young man at Hebron, the Lord is still central in his life. He is still reaching for the vision. He still has a fulfillment to receive. He is not giving up. His attitude is positive. His focus is on the Lord. And his claim is the promises that God has given to him throughout his life. He's holding on to God's promise. He says, perhaps God will go with me. It's not a statement of doubt or fear. Rather, it's a statement of hope. In fact, there was a Jewish commentator from the 1800s, a guy named Dillich, he was a German Jew. He commented on that word, perhaps, that we see in our text, where it says, perhaps the Lord will go with me and I will be able to drive the giants out. The Jewish commentator says that that word does not express fear. It expresses hope while recognizing difficulty. Hope in the midst of difficulty. The difficulty will try to weather down the resolve, but the hope will rise up to pursue the gift. I was really struck by that. Hope in the midst of difficulty. Caleb was a realist. He knew that the path would be hard. He knew that there would be challenges. He admitted that there were giants there. But he understood that his hope and his continued trust is in the Most High. Wherever you are in life, and all of us are younger than Caleb, we are not finished with our journey. I challenge you. If Caleb the Edomite could walk in prayerful humility before God, not resenting Moses or Joshua, that he didn't get the role he thought maybe he should get because he was the senior guy, he struggled for a vision. If you keep reading, actually, in the next chapter, he inspires others to fight as well. He promises that that whoever goes and captures this place called Booktown, that they could marry his daughter. And so he's challenging others to walk faithfully with vision as well. Caleb is the first one in this section of the book of Joshua to receive his inheritance. And he is the only one in the book of Joshua that said, that knew exactly what he wanted. I want this. This is my inheritance. I want to claim where I want to go. Do you have that kind of hope? Do you have that kind of vision? Do you have that kind of trust? Do you have the legacy of decades of wisdom so that you will be able to move forward in God's promises? To me, this is the challenge of the life of Caleb. I am challenged. I am believing that this is a call for our lives today. Caleb believes the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come.